Festo. Welcome back to the program, Molly.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure, of course, and it's been more than a year and a half since you and Jen Gobi were on this show talking about the RCMP's methods at the Ferry Creek blockade. Now, you were there last week, Molly. What, if anything, has changed in their behavior?
Well, they came in full force. So there was, I haven't counted the cars in my video, but there was at least 15 to 20 vehicles that rolled up around 9 a.m., probably at least 40 officers of all different disciplines of the RCMP, or the CURG, as we call them, the Community Industry Response Group, is the police force that enforces against extraction in BC, extraction protests in BC, since 2017. And they have all these different types of officers, from the, you know, we call them the green guys, ERTs, to the DLTs, which are the division liaison team, and they just communicate to the regular officers, CURG officers, to the extraction team. So they were all there. A helicopter was flying over, the drone was flying over. So all that was very similar. They came in huge numbers for what was a very small group of land defenders. Overall, they did a few things differently. One is that they played a recording of the injunction multiple times, like at least seven times, over a loudspeaker. And I believe they did that because over, I think, about 140 people's charges were dropped as a result of the RCMP, the CURG, reading a shortened script of the injunction to the protesters before arrests would take place each day. And this shortened script was not clear enough to hold the contempt charges through into the court system and out to the sentencing point. So a whole bunch of charges were dropped. And so I feel like they were very, they changed that by playing this recording that was the entire injunction, or at least a very clear version of the injunction. So that was different.
Well, and that was just a couple of weeks ago that those court, that those 100, I'm looking at a TC front page article written by Michael John Lowe and Jeff Bell. Jeff Bell, I know, he's been on the paper for a very long time. And they say that 146 cases were thrown out August, I think, 8th, 7th or 8th, because of the reasons that you cite, that they hadn't been given the proper injunction warning before. At least that's what the court deemed. It's a pretty long article. I'm assuming you've read it. It seemed pretty good to me, except one thing. I don't see the CURG mentioned once in this article. Mm-hmm. Would you think that's an oversight? Are they difficult to identify as the CURG when they come in? Like, so reporters like Jeff Bell wouldn't realize what he was looking at?
Well, he wasn't there on Tuesday.
There's the first problem.
And I don't know if it was like a purposeful oversight. I mean, the CURG is what is the group that enforces these injunction type situations. These contempt of court situations. So whether he was assuming people knew or just didn't put it in, but that is who does. And it is obvious the cars have it written on them. It's not written on their uniforms. Like, it's not like there's nothing on their uniforms that states they're CURG in the moment. But that is the group that enforces these situations.
Well, and you got a photo on the front page here. It's a pretty big piece too, like a third page photo. And it shows some of these officers. They look like they're armed for bear. Tasers, pistols, pepper spray, batons. This is what I can see. And the article, Michael John Lowe and Jeff Bell's piece, they do mention that these guys came in with helicopters, multiple vehicles, 20 guys. I think they're getting information from you at this point, though, right?
Yeah, they definitely I don't know where 20 came from, but yeah.
Do you think there was more or less than that?
I think there was more. I mean, I really haven't gone through and like counted, but there's some images I have where I can just see 20 and they're just the blue ones, not the green guys or the gray guys or this person, people in the helicopter or the people that probably stayed in their cars or the people that were in the police driving the police van or the person that does the processing, you know? There was definitely people I never saw.
And the drone operators too, presumably. Can you tell
Yes.
people the difference between the, say, the green and the blue guys, the RCMP guys?
Yeah, so the green guys are ERTs, and that, as far as I know, and they're like a emergency response team or tactical team. So they're dressed in green, and they're kind of more of a militarized. They're fitter. They're the ones that, you know, would sneak through the woods. They're the ones that take they have like rope skills. They'll drop out of helicopters. They didn't this time, but they, you know, they're the ones that have done more sort of extreme policing, if that makes any sense. Whereas the sort of regular Kurg officers are dressed like a police officer in all for all intents and purposes. Look
Yeah.
like a well-armed police officer.
Yeah, well armed is for certain. And you say that this was a small, a small protest. This, I mean, last year, maybe you could describe, like, when we, me and you talked, first of all, last year about your article and with Jen Gobi too, the CERG, the resource extraction industry's best ally, that was put up in Briar Patch and was the second part of a two-part piece on the same topic that you had written back then. The these the militarized aspect of these guys is a big part of this, but also even more important, and I guess the irony is they're called the community and industry resource, but they don't seem very communitarian in appearance or in behavior.
No, I mean they say they're speaking to all the parties involved, but that can be them speaking to band councils or and they do come in the DLT, so the DLT are these guys in gray. They just have a gray sort of golf shirt on. It says DLT on the back. They're less armed, they're less imposing. They come and speak to the people at the front line, try to, you know, they came the day before, three of them, to on the Monday, saying, you know, I want to make sure everybody stays safe, and I just want to make sure you understand your rights, and if you're blocking the road, it's breach of the injunction, all these kinds of things. So like they could be calling that, you know, community communication, but the actual like who are the stakeholders when it comes to old growth forests? Who are the stakeholders when it comes to putting a pipeline under a river? I mean, we would say it'd be the people of the land, so the indigenous people who are from that place. But then we have the complications of band councils and hereditary chiefs and just actual indigenous people who are ni neither of those things, who care about the land that they are, you know, from. And then, of course, when it comes to old growth forests, as we see the entire BC burning and the interior of BC burning and entire communities being destroyed, I mean, the stakeholders are all of us when it comes to the fact that old growth forests or original forests don't burn the way plantation forests do, the fact that indigenous people stewarded these lands and did controlled burns and looked after the land in a way that would have prevented these kinds of catastrophes from happening on such a large scale. So, you know, when it comes to communicating with the community, it's our entire survival that we're trying to work on here, not just, you know, from the point of view of indigenous land back, which is sort of the root of it or the sort of core of it all. It is about the survival of everyone.
Yeah, and this response, again, I'm looking at the picture here. I see 13 or so policemen in the picture, and that's not everybody, as you describe. But this wasn't like last year. I mean, last year there was hundreds of people getting involved far and wide. The organization was really extensive and very impressive, and it would have to be to see 2,000 people arrested. But this time, as you mentioned, it's not. It was this was a small. A small protest. Is there any hope that interest can be ignited this time as it was last year and the year before?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it can have the momentum. I think that when it comes to revolutionary sort of watershed moments that I will tentatively say Fairy Creek might have been, there's always a lot of other factors involved. And I think one of the big factors that happened to be happening at that time was that no one was working. COVID had shut down so many things. And so you had a lot of people who were just out of work and available to give their time and energy and life to a movement like that. I don't know if like you can recreate those environmental or societal factors and just replicate them in exactly the same way. But I do think what is happening on the ground at Fairy Creek is very impactful, because that small group of people, Indigenous led movement that's happening there, and the raid that took place on Tuesday was big news. It traveled around. It was on Brandy Morin was there. Her piece was on Democracy Now!, which is like an international news. So like it doesn't have to be thousands of people for it to be impactful and make the world know that there's still people standing up for the land and for the forest and for the water and for Indigenous sovereignty. It doesn't have to be that many people for it to make an impact, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Just that little raid, that big raid against that small, strong group of people was a big deal.
Yeah. Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Molly Murphy. Molly is a BIPOC activist, journalist, researcher, and social justice warrior. She was up at Fairy Creek last year and was arrested, as we mentioned, and she was up there during this raid that happened last week when three more were arrested. Brandy Morin, as you mentioned, was at Fairy Creek last year. She's got a piece up at the Ricochet today, just out today. Today is a good day to die. Brandy Morin reports from a new RCMP raid at Fairy Creek. When you mentioned, Molly, the fires, I wonder, you've got all this international media that is watching British Columbia right now. And the connection, you mentioned some of it, but just the connection between the forestry and these fires, I don't know if that's really appreciated, where a monoculture comes in, it's perhaps glyphosate sprayed. They're not doing the proper controlled burns, as you mentioned, is a traditional practice. Do you think people have an idea of what the connection between modern industry and these huge fire events are?
I don't think it's widely enough known. I think that it's because you see it in the food industry, you know, if you have like monocrops of particular types of food, and then you have a particular fungus or bug that likes to eat it or destroy it or rot it, then that entire crop is gone. And you see that when people start to move over to other kinds of the ways that food used to be grown in a more diverse way, and then have it more resilient food system. It's the same thing with forestry. You have like one crop of trees that is growing, and you have something like the pine beetle, which, you know, destroyed huge amounts of wood to be usable in the same way. So it's not like something we haven't seen before. I just think that there's too much money and subsidies and government, you know, things going on that prevent there to be the kind of change we need to see in the forestry industry in BC. There's too much investment on the ways that the money has been made, the systems that have set up to make the money to grow wood in the productive, financially, it's not even financially stable, but in the ways where the systems of money have been working over time in the wood industry are all set up to continue working the way they have been. And that seems to be hard to shift. Public knowledge would be public knowledge, and that information being spread more widely might help. But sometimes I doubt the ability of the public to shift policy when our governments are so controlled by the corporations that they service.
Well, and the one being serviced right now is Teal Jones, and the forestry that's going on right now isn't a rotational forestry. These are obviously irreplaceable trees. The percentage of old growth valley bottom trees on Vancouver Island is minuscule. I'm not sure if anyone knows, but it's certainly under 2% or something like that. Do you have those figures, Molly? Do you know?
I don't know Valley Bottom specifically, but I know that during the Fairy Creek, height of the Fairy Creek protests, we were at like 2.7 left old growth forests in BC. So less than 3% of our original forests are still intact and they're continuously being logged.
And Teal Jones, I saw a report up, or at least it wasn't a full report, but pictures up of a product that they're offering, which is cedar shingles. Is this what these majestic trees are being reduced to for just shingles for people's roofs?
Some of it's shingles, some of it's wood pellets. I mean,
Wood pellets.
yeah. I mean, a
Jeez.
lot of the there's like when they, I'm sure this old growth cedars are probably getting turned into, that's where the money is, I think, and like the in the old growth cedars and the old growth fir, where it can turn into high quality lumber that gets shipped to other places. But there's a lot of other, like there's a lot of hemlock, and other types of trees in these forests that just get cut along with it. And some of them just get left lying there, and some of them just end up being t turned into pellets or other kinds of, not high value lumber.
I
But
mean,
what we
it's
do
more
is, yeah.
shocking that way, but I guess it shouldn't be. I mean, once the trees are wiped out, I guess it doesn't matter what if they're used for toilet paper or for fine furniture. I mean,
Exactly.
they're wiping out these. Can you describe for people who aren't aware, and some of our listeners aren't, from Canada, they have no idea what an ancient forest perhaps looks like, or maybe they see pictures of it here and there, these fantastic trees and ecosystems. But what is the value of these ecosystems, these original ecosystems?
Well, they have no,
I don't mean
their
value and
value, I
in
know you don't mean monetary, but their
yeah.
value is in their intact form. So their value is in the diversity, the biodiversity that exists there, the evolutionary history that exists there. And obviously we know that the having deciduous trees or the undergrowth, the understory, the mosses capture and hold so much water. They cool the planet because they have so much water. And as the land comes, the Pacific Northwest, where these forests exist, as it sort of goes from the ocean to the land, that's often very drastic in its height changes. Therefore, there's massive cooling, and through that cooling, because it's over top of forests, where it is still over top of forests, creates clouds, and those clouds create rain, which disperses across other parts of the world and cools the air for all of us, and obviously makes oxygen and creates habitat for all kinds of animals, bugs, fungus, moss, lichen, all the things that are not really quantifiable. But I have one beautiful story, which I hope we have time to share. So I was up at Ridge Camp, which is the top of the Water Creek, Fairy Creek watershed, and there's a beautiful old hemlock. Again, no real value in this tree in the logging industry, but it's at the very top of this ridge. So one side of this ridge is clear cut, and the other side is Fairy Creek watershed, which is uncut. And this tree sits at the top. And it was during those crazy hot heat domes in the July or August of 2021. It was crazy hot everywhere, but in the forest it was much cooler. At the base of this tree, there's like a crotch where it's kind of open, and inside the bottom of this tree was a pool of cold, brownish, tannin-colored water that was just in the middle of a drought and the one of the hottest days ever recorded in BC. There's this pool of cold water slightly leaking out onto the forest floor, out of the crotch of this tree. So this tree is reaching deep into the earth at the top of a ridge of, like, I don't even know what the height is, like 1,000 meters. I could be wrong, above sea level, pulling water up from the ground and leaking it slowly onto the forest floor. And that's just one tree in one place.
Yeah, what strikes me is our ignorance about I read somewhere that there's something like that we know of 500 different species that will live on a single giant cedar. And
Right.
when you get up into the high canopy, there's things there there's species up there yet to be discovered, let alone underneath the ground and the kind of interrelations between trees and forests that we're just now beginning to understand haltingly. But that's research that it won't be able to be done. It won't
No.
happen in the aftermath of these places. And I've ridden around Renfrew and done the loop on my motorcycle and seen the clear cuts in around there. And even for me, who've lived here on the island for a long time, it was shocking. Can you describe what a clear cut looks like for those uninitiated?
It looks like a post-apocalyptic, like science fiction wasteland. It's generally fairly impassable because there's, I've hiked through quite a few of them, and they're very difficult terrain, because there's just like sticks and branches and roots and stumps everywhere. It's dry. It's crackly and broken and blonde and brown. Like the colors are so. Like you can look over to an old growth forest and see, a thousand shades of green, and you look over at a clear cut and you just see yellows and browns, and scratch. Like I think of scratches. The amount of times I've walked through them, I just feel my legs being scratched as I'm walking through, being poked by like these dead things. It's a wasteland of a void of life. A void of creation. Because when you say, like, these species that haven't been discovered yet, we have no idea what we've already lost. We have no idea what creatures and species existed only in a particular valley that had been evolving for millennia that are now gone forever. Like, we'll never know. And there's heartbreak in that for sure. But yeah, they're ugly, desolate, and they're in my mind they're full of like you see it and you because you know what it used to be, there's pain in it when you look at it.
Yeah, it's a shock to the system. I'm not often surprised, but boy, the first time I came around a corner and saw that, I just thought, Jesus. Well, we are fast running out of time, Molly. But you mentioned, or at least it's mentioned in the TC article, they quote you as saying that the police were trying to intimidate you as a identified media person. This was something that happened last year and in 2021 as well, and there was much made of it about these media exclusion zones, and that went to court, and it was deemed that the RCMP actions in that instance were not legal. And now, are they continuing in that behavior despite the fact that the court saying that that media cannot be treated like that?
They were definitely corralling us into a certain area. They threatened us with obstruction, being arrested for obstruction, multiple times as we were trying to like stay within, vision of what was going on. We were allowed to stay within reasonable vision of what was going on, but again, this was a very small blockade. It wasn't a lot of people. There wasn't anybody locked into a hard block. But they were, and at one point when the Indigenous woman was being arrested and she was being taken away, Brandy was tried to go with her, like to keep media, public eye on Indigenous woman under police custody. I think it's important. It's what we need to be doing. We need to be keeping our eye on Indigenous people as they're being taken into police custody. Everyone, but especially Indigenous people. And she was stopped. And unable to follow her as she was being taken away by a police officer. I think Charney was actually the one who's notorious. And but in the end, the DLT came along and did escort her to be able to witness the furthering of the arrest. So that did happen in the end, but not without her like being very clear about her rights as a media person to be able to access the public's access to seeing these things going down. So if you didn't have people that were strong and know their rights, like Brandy and Amber Bracken was there as well, who know their rights as journalists and know what they're allowed to do, then a lot of this stuff, if the cops could have it their way, there wouldn't be eyes on these things, on these important things.
Yeah, well, getting eyes on it, that Brandy Moran's article again is up at Ricochet, and that is ricochet.media. Her piece is "Today is a Good Day to Die. Brandy Moran reports from a new RCMP raid at Ferry Creek." It's just out right today, at least on the line that I'm looking at as well. And you mentioned video. How do people get a peek at the video that you took, Molly?
Well, there you can see some of the images that I took on the Abolish Kyrgyz on Instagram. So the Abolish Kyrgyz Instagram account has some of the most recent photos from that raid. Also following Brandy Moran on Instagram, Brandy Moran stories. She's constantly posting great and important things that need to be seen by the public. I haven't posted really any videos from that day, other than a short one that's just little clips of that day. None of the longer videos have I had a chance to go through and edit because editing's not my strongest suit yet. So I'm still working on that skill set.
Well, I did have up before we began your piece that or at least the interview that we did last year, a year and a half, I can't believe it. But you can go to guerrilla-radio.com and do a search for Molly's name, Molly Murphy. And I did a piece with you and Dr. Jen Gobi again. Up from the ground, and you can go, listeners, to that to get a background as well, and check out Brandy's piece up at the Ricochet, as I mentioned. Well, Molly, thanks a lot for coming on and telling us a little bit about it today, eh?
Oh yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome. Thanks for being interested.
And I want to thank too Rifat Awdeh and remind people of his film. And you can go to his website, truthlostatsea.com, and you can find out about viewing his film on the fate of the Mavi Marmara, seized by Israel and 10 people on board shot dead. Thanks again, Molly, though, eh?
Yeah, thank you.
Only telling when it should be time to show. Keep burning.